again, it's April 26, 2007, and we are the Image Doctors, a production of Nikonians Talk Radio. I'm Jason O'Dell.
I'm Rick Walker, and this is episode number 39.
Sweet. We've made it this far. Yep. We're still on the air.
Yep.
Probably just because we keep uploading these things and no one has been smart enough to throw us out yet.
It seems to work that way.
Total control.
Yeah.
All right.
We're persistent, if nothing else.
That's right.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about our topics for today. First of all, we're going to talk a little bit about white balance.
And that's something we've talked about a little bit before in the past, but we realize it's been a while, and we wanted to give a little bit more deep thoughts on the philosophy of how to set white balance and what it's doing.
Yep. And we've had several requests for topics that are good for beginners, so hopefully this will help new photographers as well, but we'll probably dive down a little bit, as usual, into some detail. And then after that, we're going to talk a little bit about the auto ISO function.
Yeah, that's been coming up a lot. I've seen a lot of questions about it. When do I use it? Why do I use it? And with the current implementation of auto ISO on the newer Nikon DSLRs, it's actually kind of useful, more so than it ever used to be on some of the earlier cameras.
Yeah, because a long time ago the advice was turn it off, and now I think the advice would be, it can be pretty handy sometimes. So we'll talk about why that is. And then both of us get a lot of emails from people about shooting locations where we live here in Colorado. So we thought we would go ahead and actually talk a little bit about that. And it's always nice to do non-technical topics too, I think. And so we'll talk about some of our favorite places to shoot in the state.
And then wish I was on vacation.
Yep.
And of course, we will give you at the end of the show our weekly prescription.
Yep.
So let's start off with our favorite topic of the day, which is white balance. I know it can seem a little daunting.
Mm-hmm.
What is white balance, and why is it so important? I mean, I think if there's one thing you want to do with a digital camera, I mean, there's two things you always want to try to get right on your shot. One is the exposure, mm-hmm. and the other one is the white balance.
Mm-hmm.
And this is especially true if you're shooting in JPEGs, mm-hmm. where you have a little bit less latitude to fix things after the fact.
Yeah.
So why is there this white balance setting on our camera, Rick? Why is it there in the first place?
Well, let's look to history for the answer to that. History is our friend. Now,
I thought physics was our friend.
Or chemistry, or I can't remember which it is. If you go back to the film days, of yore, so long ago now it seems.
And back in my day, we had film and we loved it.
That was good for you. And you were shooting color print film, then one of the things that would happen is, oftentimes if you didn't have a good photo finisher that you were using, you'd get back pictures that you took indoors, and, the lighting under incandescent lights would be all orangish or, kind of reddish and ugly. Under fluorescent lights, everyone would come out kind of green looking.
Oh, yeah.
Now, again, if you had a good processor that you were using, they would be able to fix some of those problems for you, and sometimes they would do that. But they would make adjustments to the color balance. If you were shooting slide film, well, there was no way of doing that, so what you did instead is you used filters on the front of your lens to alter the light, and it might be a blue one if you were shooting under incandescent lights, and that offset the orangish light, ended up with something that looked pretty neutral. And under fluorescent lights, you use these filters that were kind of reddish tinged, magenta tinged, and it would do the same thing. But you had to think about that at the time and determine the right filter and take care of it that way. So you had this problem of color balance with film too.
And
go ahead.
And speaking about color balance, below the fundamentally, why do we have the problem in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And it has something to do with whether it's film, digital, or otherwise, a camera records things in a very objective way. It's just recording information onto a piece of film or onto a digital sensor,
mm-hmm.
and the mixture of the wavelengths of light are recorded relatively faithfully, actually. Just it goes on there it interacts with the film or the sensor. The camera doesn't have a brain like we have. And if you are put into...
Thank God.
Well, you know, people wish they'd had them.
No, I'm kidding.
But my point that I'm trying to make here is that in light, you know, white light, what is white light? Well, white light is a mixture of pretty much all of the components of the visible spectrum. Your brain is able to compensate for slight differences, and you perceive things as being, quote, neutral white light, mm-hmm. whether it's under fluorescence or incandescence or daytime light. Yeah, and sometimes when it gets more extreme, like at the end of the day when the sun is setting and you're in that golden hour, definitely the light takes on a more warm appearance. But you don't walk into a room with illuminated by cool white fluorescence and think everything looks greenish.
Right.
Because your eye not only doesn't notice the difference in the spectrum, but your brain is also able to perceive things in a certain way. The camera can't do that.
Except if it has auto white balance, it can do some of that.
Correct.
And that's what auto white balance is. It's that thing that's similar to what your brain does under different lighting conditions that ensures that a white shirt like you're wearing right now stays a white shirt in under different lighting. Only it doesn't work as well as the human brain does. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work over as broad of range. We'll talk more about that. But the whole point is to have objects rendered in the colors that you saw at the time.
Right. And whether or not that's done automatically or by setting something, the whole reason for having that white balance setting on your digital camera is to do that, mm-hmm. is to correct for differences in the spectrum so that white objects look white or neutral objects look mm-hmm. neutral. And in the film days, you know, there were different films that you could get. Most of the time when you would buy a piece, you know, think way, way back to when you had film, it would say color daylight film mm-hmm. because the color palette of that film was balanced for outdoor daylight spectrum. Or you could buy something called tungsten film,
right,
which was more balanced to the spectrum given off by incandescent lamps, which have tungsten filament. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't use them in the right situation, you would get
bad.
Weird stuff.
Yes.
But now that we have digital cameras, we have this flexibility of being able to change the white balance, but we also have that problem of we have to try to get it right. Mm-hmm. So
one thing I will say is, like a lot of things in photography, it's easy to over obsess on this topic too. The whole point is to get it close. It's not, you don't have to worry about absolutely nailing it. It's just to get it close.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So how do you set your white balance on a digital camera?
Yeah. Let's start off talking about some of the manual ways of doing mm-hmm. it. There are presets that you can access on your camera. It depends on the camera how you do it. Usually you can do them via buttons and then twiddling dials, or you can do it off the menu. And in that case, you might select something called a daylight white balance or a cloudy white balance or one for shade. And the daylight one of those three would be the coolest, you know, the bluest light. The cloudy one would be a little bit warmer, a little bit more toward the yellow and red side, and then shade even stronger. And that's to balance out the light that you would get under those circumstances if you were outside.
Yeah, and why you mentioned the blue mm-hmm. and versus sort of a orange, mm-hmm. I guess would be the way to perceive it.
Yeah, different ends of the spectrum.
Why is it? Now, if you set your camera on shade preset and you take a picture in daylight, it's going to look really orange. Mm-hmm. Why is it doing that? Well, why is the sky blue? If you go into shade where you don't have direct sunlight, you get that bluish cast to the light. You don't perceive it with your brain mm-hmm. as being any different, but the camera will see it as being very blue. So
very
by
blue.
Setting a shade or a cloudy or a, what we would say a warmer white balance setting, by making the image more orange overall, it'll balance out that blue and you'll end up with something neutral. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're trying to do.
Right. Now, you know, earlier you were talking about the importance of white balance. And if you are shooting in a JPEG format, this is one of those things that's set at the time that you make the photo. And changing that white balance really can't be done. You can do edits in Photoshop or something like that to make the image cooler or warmer, but the white balance is baked in. If you're shooting in RAW, then that's actually something that you can change later on. And in the case of shooting with RAW, you can worry less about this. It's kind of convenient to get it right at the start. So that way you don't have to worry about changing it in the editing process, but it's not a terrible thing if it's RAW.
Where you will run into problems even in RAW, from what I have found, is that if you are really off on your white balance and you have some areas that have potentially blown or nearly blown highlights, then when you change the white balance setting in your post-processing, you might get funny green or orange kind of looking highlights because there's not enough image data there to blend out in the RG, all three of the RGB channels. So you still want to get it more or less right, but you have tremendously more latitude if you're in RAW than you would if you were in JPEG. So those are the, you know, that's kind of the high fast one over, you know, what you're trying
settings,
to do. Yeah, and you got those and they have little different icons like the sunshine or the lightning bolt is flash and the cloud, you know, so just go through your manual and look at those.
And if you choose to, you can set what are called color temperatures that are in degrees Kelvin. We're not going to spend a lot of time in those, but it's another approach. And daylight is somewhere between 5200, 5500 Kelvin. It just depends on, I guess, the standard you're using.
We don't want to go into color temperature in this. White balance is one thing, and it's related to color temperature, but let's just not.
Right.
Now, one thing you can do, though, is you can usually fine-tune any one of these presets. You have some latitude within the preset to make it cooler or warmer, and that's where you'll see the daylight plus or minus adjustment. You can go plus 1 through 3, usually, or minus 1 through 3. How does that work?
Well, on most of the Nikon cameras that I can think of, that's something that you can adjust, you know, while holding in a white balance button or something like that, and turning the front subcommand dial, as opposed to the back one, which sets, you know, whether it's daylight or cloudy or whatever. And you can see the change on there go from 0 to minus 1 to minus 2. That would be changing it in the warmer direction. Plus settings make it in the cooler direction.
Which I, again, find completely intuitively not obvious, but I'm sure there's a good reason for it. I don't care.
What the heck?
If you put in minus, it makes it warmer. If you put in plus, it makes it cooler or more bluish looking.
So just a way of fine-tuning.
Rarely do I go more than plus or minus 2 in any one direction.
Right.
And usually I find myself going in the minus direction.
Me too.
To warm things up. That tends to be where the preset might be a little bit too cool.
Yeah. One little piece of trivia too is that at least on all the Nikon cameras I've worked with, once you dial in that minus setting, like maybe you create a daylight minus 2 setting, whenever you go to daylight, that's what'll be there. It doesn't disappear when you switch to cloudy and then go back. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah. Your white balance in the camera is set as a combination of the preset plus its adjustment. And so it doesn't reset that adjustment.
Right.
Cool.
All right. So we talked a little bit about the manual settings and we'll talk a little bit about later about when those are handy. But let's talk about the one that a lot of people use, which is the automatic setting.
Because who wants to figure out white balance? Let the camera do it for you, right?
Yeah. And it works pretty well under certain conditions. But it's important to know what those conditions are.
Everything has its limitations.
It does. Yeah. And normally, with my cameras and what I'm using right now are D200 and D2X, I will normally set my white balance on auto minus 2. So that's an automatic white balance setting that's a little bit warmer than the standard amount. And that's just what I like.
And you got to understand that what you like has to come from what subject you're shooting. And what conditions you're shooting your subject in.
And for me, you know, shooting a lot of landscapes and nature and travel things, I find this setting, you know, works pretty well most of the time if I'm out there in, you know, outdoor type conditions. It's a pretty good setting.
And we're also in Colorado where the air is very thin and you get a lot of cool light no matter.
Right.
So that minus 2, you might find that minus 1 is plenty where you live. But that's what we think are I have found the same thing, that the auto by itself, if I just turn on auto white balance, it tends to be a little bit cooler than what I want. And it's not because it's getting it wrong. I think I just like psychologically that slightly warmer.
Yeah.
Slightly warmer image.
Me too.
Because if you go back outside and you look at it, you say, oh, you know, it probably was right. It probably got the white balance pretty close to being right.
Yeah.
Especially in daylight conditions.
It's the same reason that if I'm shooting slide film, I tend to like using slide films that have a little bit warmer palette. So, yeah, just a
and that's that thing. Whole creative side of photography is, are you trying to faithfully record the exact as it looked, or are you trying to record something as you would want to perceive it in your mind?
Yeah, and I always go for the latter.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Okay. So auto is pretty handy, but as I was alluding to, it really works best in outdoor type of situations. When you get under those darned incandescent lights that we were talking about earlier, household lighting and stuff,
yeah,
you know, with a lamp, it just doesn't really work well. You'll still end up with very orange looking images. So what I would recommend is, under those circumstances, consider using a manual setting of some sort. It could be the incandescent lighting setting. For fluorescent lights, those are also a problem, and you'll want to use a fluorescent lighting setting or some other things that we'll talk about in just a sec.
Right, and then one other thing to keep in mind when you're using auto white balance, another area where it doesn't seem to hold up too well is when you're using a flash as the primary light source. It just doesn't quite get it. And we've talked about this in the other context, which is, how do I make my flash shots look better? Set the white balance, take it out of auto, and put it on the flash setting.
It will look a lot better.
It will
look
a heck of a lot better.
You'd be surprised. Especially if you're taking photos of people.
Mm-hmm.
They'll look much better.
Otherwise, they kind of look pallid.
Mm-hmm.
Not so good.
They're just too blue looking.
Now, on most of the Nikon cameras, you have one final choice for white balance, and that's using a custom preset. And when you get your camera out of the box, that custom is not set to anything. It's just, you know, I don't even know if it has a setting. Mm-hmm. It might. Someone can look it up somewhere. But the idea here is that you're going to use a target of some kind that you know is a neutral color, or, you know, use the lighting conditions in which you're shooting. If you know that, let's take the most horrible example that we can ever think of is like gymnasium lighting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're shooting in a gym where you've got some sort of weird, not really fluorescent, but, you know, those arc light indoor light.
Could be weird.
Just
sodium, God only knows,
yeah.
Who knows what.
Well, if you have a good way of pointing the camera at a neutral toned object, either a neutral gray or white, and taking a snapshot of that fills the frame, then the camera can say, ah, okay, I know that's supposed to be neutral, and it'll do the calculations inside, and then now you've got this preset setting, and you can just use that for all your shots.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two ways that you can, the main way of doing this is with one of the tools that we've talked about is our stocking stuffer episode once, and that's something called an Expo Disc. And what it is that it's kind of like a filter. It's sort of a translucent,
diffusing.
Yeah, you know, it looks kind of white, and you screw this thing on the front of your lens. You point it at the light source that you're under, and you snap an image.
And what you've essentially told the camera by doing that is, I want that lighting source to look white, as opposed to maybe orange or green or whatever.
Whatever it might be.
That's all that's happening.
Another thing you can do is, we talked about using a Weibull card, and you can use a Weibull gray card, which is a white balance gray card, not to be confused with a neutral 18% exposure gray card.
Mm-hmm.
If you fill the frame with that and do your custom preset shooting the image, that'll work too.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried that and it works. And if you have a D2 camera that has that little eye on the top, that kind of works like an Expo disc. It's that little white.
Right.
And you can use that to capture the white balance information instead of what's coming through the lens. And that works pretty well if you are in the same lighting as it's falling on your subject.
Mm-hmm.
That can work. But then the other thing you can always do is shoot that Weibull card and do it in post-processing later.
Right.
So again, you'll still want to have set the white balance to something that's at least reasonably close mm-hmm. for the situation. So whether you're using auto or another setting, because you don't want to change the white balance so drastically that it really affects highlights in your images. But you can, that's the other way out. You take your first shot that has this gray card in it and then use the eyedropper, whether it's an ACR or Capture NX, whatever, and batch that across all your images. And then you know, you've got them right. Mm-hmm. So that's something you can always try. Now, one thing we want to point out is that different camera models sometimes handle white balance differently. So if you hear someone telling you a setting, oh, just set your white balance to cloudy -3, and that's the way to do it. White balance settings don't have a lot of meaning when they're taken out of context. And by context, we mean the subject that you're shooting, the lighting that you're under, and the camera model that you're using.
Right.
So, you know, you're going to have to find what works for you.
Yeah, that cloudy -3 thing was a tip that was floating around quite a few years ago when digital SLRs were new. And unfortunately, it was taken out of context. It was talking, when the tip came up, it was talking about wildlife photography, things like deer and moose, which look good with very warm white balances. If you shoot them neutral, they just kind of look lifeless almost. And so it was a great tip for those subjects.
And especially if deer in the shade.
Right. Yeah. It was an awful tip though for taking pictures of people, unless you want them to look like pumpkins. it's not my favorite look. And it was really too warm for most things. So, you know, as a general purpose setting, you know, my own recommendation would be more like a daylight -2 or something like that, or use one of the auto -2 or -1 mm-hmm. kind of settings.
By and large, the auto setting will get you pretty close. Mm-hmm. You know, that's usually a good, it might not be dead on, but it's probably pretty good for most outdoor situations.
But just do your own experimentation. It's so easy with digital and you can see what you prefer. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of times you don't really want whites to be white, or everything is a neutral gray to be a neutral gray.
Right, because you can capture mood by changing white balance.
Right, and you know, we've talked in the past about the golden hours, you know, early morning, late afternoon, and what made those so great is the whites weren't white. They were kind of a golden color. And so there's a danger too here. You don't really want to always neutralize the whites in your photos. That can be the worst thing to do.
Yeah, and if you're shooting a daylight picture with a blue sky or something with a lot of blues, if you crank the white balance too warm, all of a sudden your nice blue sky turns kind of brownish looking,
right,
and it's not so good.
Right.
So you might need to play with that. Now, it's really fun. You can do some white balance tricks in the camera to emulate different times of day, even when you're not.
Right.
So like, for example, when's the worst time of day to shoot? Well, we always say high noon. That's terrible, right? Mm-hmm. But if you were to dial in, say, a manual Kelvin setting of, say, 9,000 or 10,000 degrees Kelvin.
Which is very warm.
Which is incredible. It's as warm as it goes. That's the highest value you can get. It's kind of like shooting in the golden hour. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work with every subject, but it's great for things like silhouettes. And if you're a JPEG shooter, you've just done this without, it's in your image. You don't have to do any post-processing. You can get these very interesting moods, or you can do the opposite. Set the white balance really cool, you know, down around, you know, 4,000 Kelvin or less.
Right.
And you can make this moody blue kind of lighting. Right. Right. Really get creative with it.
Right. And although using white balance to do that is a newer thing, it's a very old trick. And what photographers would do in the past is use warming filters, some of the more extreme ones, and then use them in those conditions. Things like an 81C, which was a pretty warm filter, mm-hmm. or an 81EF, which was really warm. And there were some cool shots made. They're not the kind of things that you want to do all the time. But you can certainly do that. And incidentally, we've talked in the past about the Nikon A2 filters mm-hmm. as a stocking stuffer idea. That was just a mild warming thing. And that gave you that kind of -2 sort of look to your photos.
So, yeah, and the reason why we don't recommend those filters for digital is because your auto white balance is going to
take it right out.
It's going to compensate that out. So right, there's no point right. in spending the money on
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Well, but they are nice for film cameras.
So have we sort of covered this white balance topic?
I think so.
I'm sure.
Although I believe we have a prescription later on for how to do some of this on the cheap.
Yep.
And we'll save it for then.
Because we get so many comments that we're costing people too much money.
And we do have an evil streak. We enjoy that. But we're going to give you a cheap one later.
Okay. Well, let's move on to auto ISO.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something like that is, I didn't really discover until I had my D2X for a while. I played with it. I couldn't quite figure it out. And then I played with it some more. And I didn't use it all that much until the firmware 2.0 for the D2X came out. Because then it really set auto ISO as a tool that was usable mm-hmm. for me. And the D200 has this setting. And in fact, all of the more recent Nikon bodies, we did a quick check, they all have this auto ISO function that works in a similar way from the D40 on up. So the D40, the D80, D200, and the D2s have this function. And this used to be something that they would tell you not to even bother with because it was one of those black boxes. You weren't sure what the camera was really doing.
Yeah, and it was a good way to end up with really grainy looking photos unexpectedly.
Yeah, and as a general rule, we always the idea of any photographic shoot is that you want to have your exposure right, and you want to try to shoot at the lowest ISO that you can for the given exposure parameters. But what happens when you're in rapidly changing lighting situations or you need to keep the shutter speed high, but you're using a lens that, you know, at some point you can only open up the aperture so far. If you're using an F4 lens, for example, then mm-hmm. that's the most you can get. And if you're in shutter priority, you run into that situation where all of a sudden your shots are coming out underexposed because it's hit that physical limit of not being able to have enough light. Well, auto ISO is a way around that problem.
Mm-hmm. So tell me what it's doing in the most basic terms.
Well, the idea with auto ISO is that you set your camera to, I'll use it in the example in manual exposure mode, mm-hmm. because I think that's the easiest way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
If I put my camera in manual mode, and let's say I set a shutter speed of 250th of a second and f5.6.
Mm-hmm.
I'll either have enough light or not enough light for the ISO that I've set.
Mm-hmm.
If I use auto ISO, then the camera will keep the shutter speed and aperture the same, you know, as what I've set them, and vary the sensitivity of the sensor as needed to match the exposure that I've dialed in.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't, I can't make more light come into the camera, but I can change the sensitivity of the sensor mm-hmm. to the degree that my exposure is now correct, provided yeah. that I'm not overexposing.
Yeah, it's almost the opposite of what happens with auto exposure, where the camera is changing the aperture or the shutter speed to get the right exposure. Now, in that scenario, it's keeping those two things fixed and varying the ISO instead.
Right. And here's the issue where you run into the, in, if you don't have auto ISO, what are your, you know, before this was an option, if you shoot in aperture priority exposure mode, then you have a problem of potentially you get the fastest possible shutter speed for the aperture that you've set. But the problem is that if it starts getting dark, your shutter speed starts getting slower and slower mm-hmm. to compensate.
It could even just be a cloud that comes over the sun, you know, just for a matter of seconds.
And now instead of shooting at 125th of a second, you're shooting at 1/30th of a second. Well, if you wanted to freeze the action, that's no good. So you say, okay, well, maybe that's not what I wanted to do. Maybe I need to keep, maybe shutter speed is more important, so I'm going to put it into shutter priority exposure mode, and I'm going to set my shutter speed at a 250th. Well, let's just say you're at 1/250th and you have the 18-200 VR lens on there, and you're shooting at a focal length where now your minimum aperture, or sorry, your maximum aperture on the lens is maybe f4.5. Well, depending on the ISO that you've set, the lens can only physically open up to whatever that maximum aperture value is. And if that happens, you underexpose the shot because the shutter speed is locked in at whatever it might be, at 250th or 500th or whatever. So now that's another problem. So you find yourself manually saying, well, I need to change my ISO to compensate for this. And then you're in the middle of a shoot, like changing light conditions with wildlife or at weddings or whatever. That's not necessarily something you want to be futzing with, because you want to be spending your time with your head in the camera taking the shot, not changing settings all the time. Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy to change aperture and shutter speeds, but it's not as easy usually to change an ISO. That's something that you have to take your eye out of the viewfinder to do most of the time, unless you're really good. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you have enough light, why do I want to be shooting at ISO 800?
Right.
Because I don't want to do that either. I want to shoot at a lower ISO if I can get away with it, because, you know, that's ideal. Mm-hmm. So the current implementation of the auto ISO feature on the newer Nikon digitals answers most of those questions pretty well. So when you go into your menu setting, and it's in the custom menus, it's usually under the exposure menu somewhere in there, you'll see this thing for auto ISO. And the first thing it'll say is, do you want to turn this on or off? And by default, it's always off. So you can enable auto ISO by turning it on. But then you've got to do a few more things if you want to use it effectively. You have a couple more things to change. There's an option now for the maximum ISO value that you'll allow your camera to go up to. Now, the Nikon bodies do not allow you to go up into, by default, you cannot get to the high 1 and high 2 settings with auto ISO. It just doesn't give you there. So you're limited to the range that your camera's normal ISO values are. And then depending on your camera model, that could be from 200 or 100 up to 1600. Just depends. Mm-hmm. So like for my D2X, the range is 100 to 800. But for your D200 here, it's 100 to 1600. And, you know, on another camera, you might not get down to 100. It might be 200 to 1600. So you don't have to... You can tell your camera that you don't have to go all the way up to the highest ISO. If you want to cap it at 400 as the highest value, then you can cap it at 400.
Right.
So that's the first parameter that you can set.
And a lot of that will just depend on what your subject is. Mm-hmm. You know, some subjects, there's no problem at all going to a higher ISO and then, you know, maybe later doing a little bit of noise reduction, or, you know, maybe you're not going to make large prints, so it's not a big deal either. Mm-hmm. Other subjects, you want to stay down kind of low. It just depends.
Right. So you're setting the upper boundary of how high the sensitivity on the sensor will go. Mm-hmm. Then you have to add in the second parameter. And that second parameter is, what is the minimum shutter speed that you will allow the camera to use? Mm-hmm. And this is important if you're going to use auto ISO in aperture priority mode, where you're telling it to, where you're setting an aperture manually. But then the camera needs to know, and this was the drawback with the original firmware in the D2X, was that you couldn't use auto ISO in aperture priority mode because it didn't know what shutter speed to start kicking your ISO up.
Right.
It would just keep making the shutter speed slower and slower. So for example, you can have a really slow shutter speed, or you can go all the way up to from down to 1 second, or you can have 1/250th of a second as your minimum shutter speed. So it depends on the shooting subject that you're doing. So if I set it to 1/250th of a second and a maximum ISO of 1600, and I put the camera into aperture priority mode, what'll happen? Well, I set my f-stop. Let's say I'm shooting at f4, just for example. And what the camera's going to do, as long as there's enough light to get me at least 250th of a second or faster, mm-hmm. I'm going to be sitting there at whatever the minimum ISO value that I've set. What's the minimum? I should have pointed this out. The minimum ISO is the ISO value that you've dialed into your camera. You actually say, okay, I've set my camera to ISO 100. And it is unrelated to the auto ISO setting. So if I set my camera at 400, that sets the lower boundary of my ISO.
Right.
So you want to make sure that you've paid attention to that too. Mm-hmm. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that I set my ISO at 100. I've turned auto ISO on, I'm shooting aperture priority, and I've told the camera that the minimum shutter speed that I want is a 250th of a second. Mm-hmm. So if it's really bright outside, I might be shooting along at f4 and 1/1000th of a second. And now the light starts coming down. Maybe a cloud passes in front, or I point the camera so I'm shooting at something in the shade. The shutter speed starts dropping off to compensate for that. When I hit below, when I now have less light than what would get me to 1/250th of a second of shutter speed, the next thing you see is now the auto ISO starts kicking in, and you'll see a value in the viewfinder that goes up and tells you what the ISO is. At some point, though, you could, in theory, run out of light altogether. I mean, you're going to get to your highest ISO value, in this case, maybe 1600, and the light keeps falling off. Well, if that's the case, you're going to see the auto ISO indicator in the viewfinder start blinking at you. And what that is telling you is because it's blinking, it's telling you that, hey, I'm at the maximum ISO I can crank this up to, and there's still not enough light. And that's when you as the photographer have to recognize that and say, okay, I need to either open up my f-stop or choose a slower shutter speed. Mm-hmm. And that's where you're... That's sort of how it works.
Yeah. And really, there are a bunch of different ways you can use this function, but I'll just throw out an example. Let's say you're doing some travel photography and, you know, the area that you're in, may have, you know, some varied light, places where it's shady, places where it's fairly bright, and you're moving around quickly and there's not a lot of time to react. You may be moving through it, you know, fairly rapidly. And maybe you want kind of low-key photography, you know, nothing that you want to think too hard about. A potential way to go is put it on program mode. Maybe set your ISO setting at 100, right? Go into this auto ISO and put a max of maybe 800, something like that. You know, you could even go a little bit lower than that, but let's just say 800. Put a goal speed, shutter speed, you know, that minimum shutter speed of 1/125th of a second. You'll certainly get good handheld shots typically mm-hmm. with shorter focal length lenses at that kind of a shutter speed, and then just have at it.
In the famous words of Ron Popeil, uh-huh. you set it and forget it.
But that'll certainly work, and you'll get good shots, and you're less likely to have blurred images because of hand-holding problems, or even, you know, subjects moving a little bit. So that just can be a nice, easy way to set your camera for those kind of situations where you don't have a lot mm-hmm. of time, or you're just not wanting to think a lot for
right.
those shots.
Sometimes you want to disconnect your brain.
Yeah, that's okay.
And here's the thing. You're probably asking, well, why would you even want to do that? Why can't you just change the aperture or the shutter speed? I say 99% of the time, you're right. You mm-hmm. you can change the aperture of the shutter speed. But if you consider for a minute the impact of what shutter speed and aperture have on your image, then if you want to have the creative, you know, that one extra degree of freedom in terms of creative composition and the kind of image that you want, if I want to shoot a slow shutter speed, you know, maybe that's a bad example. If I want to shoot a fast shutter speed and I still want to retain depth of field, then I need to stop the lens down. I don't always want to shoot wide open. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm using a teleconverter and I want to stop down a stop. Well, I still want to have a fast enough shutter speed to freeze the action, because if I'm taking a picture of a deer, well, 1/30th of a second isn't going to cut it. Mm-hmm. If I'm in aperture priority mode at F8 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But if I have auto ISO enabled, it allows me to keep my shutter speed up to freeze the action and still use the smaller aperture.
Right.
You know, same thing too, you know, because aperture has an impact on depth of field. If you say, oh, well, I'll just get the shutter speed up by opening up the aperture, then you're potentially losing something.
Right.
But if I can increase the shutter speed and keep the aperture down by upping the ISO, then I have potentially a different image produced.
Yeah. And as with all camera settings and techniques, the best thing you can do is go out there and try it. Get your instruction book. See how to set this on your camera and just try some typical subjects. Try it in some of the different exposure modes and see what happens and what you prefer. The best indicator of a situation where you might want to consider using this function is one where you find yourself all of a sudden flipping back and forth between a whole bunch of different ISO settings in a certain band. Maybe that's when you want to consider using it. And it does work pretty well.
And the last thing I should point out, the take-home message here is that, number one, it always tries to choose the lowest ISO for the given mm-hmm. setting. And number two, when you put your flash on, it's disabled. Mm-hmm. So even if you have auto ISO on, if you pop up your little flash or you put on an SB800 or 600 or something like that, it'll revert to the lowest ISO you set.
Right.
So keep that in mind because it does disable it.
Okay. Next topic. We talked at the beginning about shooting locations in Colorado, and we'll just talk briefly about some ideas for some of our favorites, since we do get a lot of emails on this, which is fine. Don't mind us.
No, and if you have another question for us, don't forget, you just email us at talkradio@nikonians.org, and we'll answer your email.
Or put something on the podcast feedback form
right
on the site. So we'll start off where we live, which is in Colorado Springs, which is a popular tourist place. People like coming here, going up Pikes Peak, which is a 14,000-foot mountain just a few miles away from here. That's certainly a good place to go. Garden of the Gods, we've talked a little bit about that in past podcasts since it's so close by the area we both live in. Great shooting location, huge sandstone formations, look great under early morning light. Mm-hmm. So those are some nice places near Colorado Springs.
Before we get it too mm-hmm. much further, because we have a lot of international listeners.
Right.
Let's point something out, make it very clear.
I know what you're going to say.
Right. So you can think of Colorado. Colorado is in the shape of a rectangle, basically.
Right.
The Rocky Mountains, which is what everybody is thinking of right now, mm-hmm. they end sort of on the, not quite the middle of the state, a little bit to the east of the mm-hmm. state. And there's the what they call the Front Range, and then there's the western side of Colorado.
The western slope.
If you go and you're planning a trip to Colorado and you're flying into, say, Denver, mm-hmm. you will not be in the mountains.
No.
At all.
Picture Kansas or Nebraska, or for international listeners, very flat places.
Yeah, and the mountains are out there. They're in the distance, but when you fly into Denver International Airport,
it's the flat. First
thing you will say is, where the heck are the mountains? I thought I was in Colorado.
So the altitude may be high,
but it's deceiving.
Flat.
Yeah, it is very flat. And yeah. I mean, even Colorado Springs, we're a little bit closer to the mountains here, but we're on that Front Range eastern side.
It's a bit hillier, but still.
You're not in it the goes quote, into, mountains.
No, it's the prairie.
You will have to drive to get into the mountains.
Right.
So let's just clear that up.
Right.
If you're planning a trip and you're saying, I'll go and stay in Denver for a week, you're going to have to do some serious driving, mm-hmm. and you might want to consider doing something different.
Right. And some of that something different might include some of the other places we're going to talk about.
Exactly.
The first place that both of us thought about was Estes Park, and that's not that far from Denver. You can get there in about...
Right, two or 3 hours?
Oh, less than that. Yeah. More like an hour and a half.
Yeah,
it's pretty close. And that's situated right at the entrance of Rocky Mountain National Park, which is a beautiful national park. Huge peaks, lots of elk, a little bit of moose. What else in terms of wildlife?
Well, there was the... I photographed a prairie falcon there. That was pretty cool.
And the marmots are kind of fun.
If you find those, or pika,
yeah,
you can get those. And then aspens in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty diverse and, very...
Waterfalls.
And elk, just everywhere elk. Mm-hmm. I mean...
Yeah, beautiful place. So that's nice. Outside of Denver, not that far, maybe about 45 minutes, something like that, is another 14,000-foot mountain. It's kind of equivalent to Pikes Peak with Colorado Springs. It's called Mount Evans. And that's a favorite place of mine. With both of those mountains, you can actually drive up to the top in a passenger car. With the road that goes up Pikes Peak, it's a dirt road. The one that goes up Mount Evans is actually paved all the way to the top, which is kind of nice.
So you don't need a four-wheel drive vehicle to get
there. For either of them, no, you definitely don't. And the thing with Mount Evans is it's got some very pretty alpine lakes along the way that are beautiful. it's very easy to photograph mountain goats. In fact, if you see photos of mountain goats, there's a very high likelihood that they were taken on Mount Evans, because it's just a piece of cake to photograph them there, where you can actually stand there and they'll just come to you. I've been right in the middle of herds of mountain goats many times on that mountain. You almost have to go to a wide angle lens. Nice. It gets so silly. That's so tame. Neat. Yeah. All right.
If you're in the Boulder area, which is also not too far away from Denver, you can go to the Indian Peaks, which I haven't been to, but you think it's pretty nice.
Yeah, it is a nice area. It's just south of Rocky Mountain National Park. And, you know, Alpine Lakes, some really great hikes. Favorite of mine is Lake Isabella, which is near the Brainerd Lake campground area. Very nice and not hard at all. It does get up to pretty good altitude, you know, 11 something, I think. But really nice spot. And there are a bunch of others in the Indian Peaks area.
Okay, so if you're still on the eastern side and you drive for a few hours south of Colorado Springs towards the town of Alamosa and that area, you get into the Sangre de Cristo and the Spanish Peaks area, and there's a great national park there called Sand Dunes, Great Sand Dunes National Park, just recently became a national park. And the time of year to go, I mean, this, I've seen pictures of this in John Shaw's books, for example, and besides the fact that there are these wonderful sand dunes out there.
Big ones, really big.
There's, so think like Sahara Desert, you know, that stereotypical desert, image comes to mind. The really cool thing is that there's the water table is pretty high through and streams come through it. And so in late summer, sunflowers will just grow straight out of the sand. And you've probably seen this shot with a clear blue sky, a sand dune, and sunflowers. And just real great color, contrast, all of the above. That's where you go to get that picture.
Yeah. Great place to bring the family to, because kids love playing there in the dunes and the stream that runs through the dunes. And
so do adults, I think.
Yeah, I believe so. Yep.
Nothing more fun than jumping off of a sand dune.
Right. Now, one of the prettiest parts of Colorado is actually on the other side of the mountains.
So you got to go west. And this is not something that you would do in a day trip. This is something
you want to drive there. You can get there in a day easily, but then you want to stay there for a few days. And it's in the southwestern part of the state. And that includes the San Juan Mountains, which are down there. They're more rugged, more angular looking than the mountains nearby here. Very pretty. And, you know, a great place to stay is Durango, Colorado, or Ouray. That's the way it's pronounced. If you look, it's O-U-R-A-Y. So you would think it was Ouray or something like that. But if you're from Colorado, you pronounce it Ouray. So a little Colorado tip. Telluride, also down in that part of the state, beautiful ski town that's wonderful in the summer too, and gorgeous mountains around there.
Wildflowers like crazy.
Yeah, if you see those very stereotypical Colorado shots with the basin full of wildflowers of all different colors and everything, and the rugged mountains, invariably those are taken around the Ouray area in one of two places, the Yankee Boy Basin, which is right by Ouray, or American Basin, which isn't too far away. I photographed there several times, and if you go there in late July, early August, they're gorgeous. It's just amazing.
And one of the things you can do if you go to Ouray is rent a four-wheel drive vehicle like a Jeep, because there's a lot. It's like the four-wheel drive capital of the universe.
That's what you want to do if you go there, because otherwise you're just missing out on a lot of things. And there are, you know, really nasty four-wheel drive roads that'll scare you half to death, and some that are fairly tame. And just get some good advice from the people that you're renting the Jeep from, as to, you know, what
different
road is like. And if you haven't done a lot, stay with the easier ones.
Yeah, and if you've got all your camera stuff in the vehicle, you don't want to have it tipped over.
The scary ones are truly scary, so I'll just forewarn you. A few other places that are worth mentioning, and then we'll move on to our prescription topic. In the western part of the state, but a little bit further north. Oh, before we leave that, also in the Durango area is Mesa Verde,
which is
another national park. There are cliff dwellings there that are fabulous. Everyone's seen pictures of them probably. And it's a great place to go, both to photograph and go explore. And, you know, very interesting history, to say the least. So, great place. Further north in the state, but on the western side, There's the Glenwood Canyon area near Glenwood Springs, Hanging Lake. It's a wonderful hike.
That's easy to get to from Denver because it's just straight out on Interstate I-70. Yeah, it'll take you right there.
Right. And then also just off of I-70 over by Grand Junction is Colorado National Monument.
And I can attest to that one. Mm-hmm. It's very nice. Lots of rock formations, colors, hoodoos.
Yeah, big ones. Big ones.
And if you're in, you know, and if you're staying in Grand Junction for any length of time, you're actually not too far from getting over into Moab and Utah for those parks. But this is, we'll stick with the Colorado side of the border. It's the Colorado National Monument's pretty nice considering.
It really is. It doesn't get publicized as much, but it's a beautiful place. And I think that should probably do it. Lots of other places to go in the state, but those are some of my favorites.
And when you come and visit, we'll take you to South Park.
There is a South Park.
There is.
Okay.
So we want to finish up, as always, with our weekly prescription. And I know we get a lot of complaints about toys that you can spend all your money on. But we mentioned the Expo Disc and using the Expo Disc to set a white balance preset in our white balance discussion. But an Expo Disc, quite frankly, while they're very good, they cost about $100 or something in that in that area. They're not cheap for just something that you might, you know, it just depends on the kinds of situations that you shoot in. Before the Expo Disc, I remember seeing some people on the AMPAT, the fourth AMPAT, before I had digital, getting advice from other Nikonians as to how to make a good white balance preset. And it was one of those, you got to love this tip because it doesn't cost any money and anyone can do this. Instead of putting an Expo Disc on the front of your lens, which is just a neutral sort of semi-translucent, you know, semi-opaque white filter, you can use a coffee filter.
A white one. Yep.
Yeah, don't use a natural coffee filter that's brown. You'll get some really messed up looking. But a white coffee filter, maybe even two coffee filters, you know, because if depending on how thick they are.
And you just do the exact same thing that you would with an Expo Disc. Put it over the lens, point that at the light source, and use the whole preset white balance routine that'll be described in your camera's instruction book. Works remarkably well.
Yep. It'll get you that 99% of the way there.
Yeah, and especially if you're shooting under incandescent lights or fluorescent lights or those weird gym lights that you were talking about, that's a great way to go, and you'll be surprised at how well it works.
And if you're traveling, you know, it's not too hard to find coffee filters anywhere you go.
Nope.
And they work.
And they're small and light and compact. So there it is.
Sounds like a great tip.
It is.
If you have a suggestion for us, please don't hesitate to post in our forums at Nikonians.org or send us an email to talkradio@Nikonians.org. Also, don't forget to check out all the show notes of all the episodes if you want to. We get a lot of questions about have you covered X, Y, or Z. We have complete tables of contents and show notes over at the blog page, blog.nikonians.org. Just look under the Image Doctors link from there, and you can see all the episodes that we've done.
And with 39 of them, they're a fair number of topics.
And with 39 of them, we don't remember which one came, which one is which. So thanks again for joining us. We'll see you again in 2 weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.